Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to have the brilliant scriptwriters Lawrence Marks and Maurice Gran onto Radio Oldie. And Maurice, you've written a brilliant piece for the new issue about the extraordinary meeting between a monster and a genius. Can you tell us a little about it?
Well, a meeting that didn't happen but could have, which is to say, Mike Fried and Hitler have bumped into each other in Vienna, because Lawrence, more than I, being such a keen reader, had read a book about Hitler's childhood and for light relief followed it up with the biography of Freud and realised that when Hitler was a troubled child whose Jewish GP suggested might go to the new child clinic in Vienna, the first clinic of its kind for children with the anxiety, that was a clinic that Freud was opening. He didn't go, but we started thinking, well, what if he had gone? Would it have changed the course of history? And we then started researching. We went to Germany. We went to Freud's house. We went to Hitler's village. We found out other occasions they might have met, and we concocted. It's a conceit, in a way, a weird conceit, because either we say that Freud could have somehow have cured Hitler. We don't say that. We could have said Freud made such a terrible hash of trying to cure Hitler that he caused the war. Didn't say that either. So we had to pick our way through it and find and create a drama whilst not reassigning guilt.
Right.
And that's what we did. Did it for radio in 2007, and then quite recently a chance remark that Lawrence met someone in the theatre who said, have you ever done it for the theatre? And I think Lawrence said, not yet. And then we decided we would.
And it'll be on in September in Highgate, is that right?
Great House, Highgate, and I think it opens around early September.
And it is called Dr. Freud Will See You Now,
Mrs. Hitler. Yes, yeah. And the Gatehouse is a lovely theatre over a pub, literally on the border of Highgate and Hampstead. We expect the audience to consist almost entirely of resting psychoanalysts.
Because Freud lived not very far away.
He went to his house last week.
With the famous sofa.
Yeah.
And the famous hundreds of figurines which he collected, which are quite extraordinary. Everything from sort of Mesopotamian, Assyrian. He was obsessed with these little figures, which he used to use to draw people out, including in our play Young Adolf, who is not that impressed.
Right. And you begin your piece by talking about how 80 years on since the end of the war, we've just had the celebrations for VE Day, we're still obsessed with the war, and it inspired one of your brilliant hit series, Good Night, Sweetheart. What was the spark for that, Lawrence?
Well, Good Night, Sweetheart came about whilst writing another piece. We were writing our drama series called Love Hurts, and we were setting a scene in Whitechapel Road, East London, and one of the characters was sitting on the wall opposite Bloom's, now shut, and I said, almost en passant to Maurice, do you know that three streets behind where we're setting this scene haven't changed since the war? And Maurice said, thank you, I think you've just created our next series.
Right.
And I didn't know what he meant.
And so, I didn't know what I meant either. I just felt that, as soon as Lawrence said that, I thought a character who can walk down a street and find himself in the past would be an interesting character. And so, and we've often written about the war or the years after the war, clearly being of the age we are.
Yeah.
Young for an oldie reader, but
never very young. But also, you're both born
just after the war.
But we grew up; it was still very current and very much in not in people's subconscious, but very much in their conscious. though, what would it take if someone in the present, we were talking about the early 90s, around the time that history had officially ended, where everything was seemed to be very easy, but if you had a boring, mundane, unfulfilled life, and then you found yourself back in the past where, despite the slight problem of bombs dropping, everyone thought you were a wonderful human being who'd written the entire Beatles catalogue, why wouldn't you keep going back if you possibly could?
Right.
Particularly if you'd fallen in love with the barmaid.
So what was also interesting is that when we'd had the idea and sort of filled it out, we always knew only one person could play the central character, Gary Sparrow, and that was Nicholas Lyndhurst, although we didn't know Nicholas Lyndhurst. We met his agent one evening and told her that we wanted to write a new series for Nick, not that we knew Nick. Yeah. And she organised a lunch and we met Nicholas Lyndhurst and I think it was Morris, I said to him, you're on our short list of one. You don't want to do it, we don't do it.
But that was because we thought playing a time-travelling adulterer would be something that required a great deal of charm. What Lawrence didn't just say, in an unusual outburst of modesty, is that we met Nick's agent at the BAFTA Awards. She was on our table with her client, Alan Bates. We just won a BAFTA as best comedy writers or something. So it was a good moment to pitch an idea.
Right, yeah.
Possibly the best moment in history to pitch an idea.
Yeah, we came back to the table with the Writers' Award. An award in the gift of the Academy. I did leave that out.
Right.
And she sat down and said, oh, congratulations. And things like, we must work together. And that's it.
The gods were with you.
Yeah.
But so, in all your wonderful shows, is it often like that, a combination of just an initial spark that explains a whole series combined with brilliant actors? That's a very simplistic way of putting
it. Well, I think in terms of the spark, you see, Lawrence, I was repaying a favour when I said that sounds like our next show, because a couple of years previously I'd taken my family to the Kensington Garden Hotel for Christmas lunch rather than cook at home. We thought, let's all go out. And that's where I saw two blousy women in gold and silver lamé frocks. And when I came, who I considered, I decided they must be gangsters' moles because they looked like gangsters' moles. And when I came back and told Lawrence this, just again as a passing anecdote, he said, Linda Robson, Pauline Quirk, who we wanted to write a show for because we had worked with them before. Everyone was looking for a show for them, and that was it. And so the downside of being a comedy team is you have to split the money. But the upside is that you...
Well, they wouldn't have happened.
You can have these ideas. We often say to when we're lecturing, everyone has good ideas, but most people don't know when they've had one.
Right.
And so it's quite good if someone else knows when you've had a good idea.
And do you also fulfill a role with each other? You could say sometimes to the other one, that one's not going to work.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
When we were writing comedy for TV, Morris said would come in and say, I think I've got a germ of an idea, and yet you knew straight away it didn't have left. The thing about Birds of a Feather, Good Night, Sweetheart, Shine on Harvey Moon, I could name lots of others, New Statesman, for example, you knew they had legs. They could run and run and run, and that's what television companies want. Once you got the hit, with Birds particularly, because Birds was a smash hit from the first 28 minutes. So all BBC wanted was more and more and more and more, right. And that ran for 30-something years. But Good Night, Sweetheart, the same.
We realised that we'd stumbled quite accidentally on a good trick, which was that those shows, those Birds, Good Night, Sweetheart, New Statesman, those shows all had an inbuilt sort of timetable. One was set in Parliament, so there's a 5-year cycle. One was set in the war. We decided at the beginning that if we were lucky and it worked, we would do 6 seasons, one per year, and would reflect the progress of the war. And when we did Birds of a Feather, we said, well, if we send the men to prison for 12 years, we can do at least 8 series before they get time off for good behaviour.
Right.
And that's more or less what we did. So we've always, and in those instances, then the exterior world supplies half of your stories.
I see.
You only have to, particularly Goodnight Sweetheart, because you just had to look in the newspaper of the time and say, well, this week, Gary's lost his job and Hitler's invaded Russia. So that's your story of the week.
And also presumably helps that your audience pretty much know the story of the Second World War already, so you don't have to say Adolf Hitler, who is the leader of Germany.
They sort of know. Well, nowadays, of course, if you were working for the Youngie, we might have to tell them that.
No, it's not true, because we must get five lessons from around the world about Goodnight Sweetheart, particularly Goodnight Sweetheart, from young people, you can tell by the way they write, who are completely besotted by this era of 39 to 45 that might know nothing about it. No one has yet said who's Hitler.
I think any show with a hint of science fiction gets a following. On one occasion, I went to be on the couch, so to speak, on some Radio 2 program, start of the week, end of the week, middle of the week, one of those. And as I approached Broadcasting House, I saw 25 or 30 autograph hunters outside Broadcasting House. And I said to myself, oh, there must be someone famous on the show with me. And they all turned out to be Goodnight Sweetheart fans.
Yeah. Sweeties.
One of them.
They're cool.
And so it is a show that it won't lie down, I'm glad to say, which is good, because you know we've got three Goodnight Sweetheart related projects that we're still trying to do. So the fact there are kids who like the show who can't have been alive when it was going out, because it stopped going out in 1999, which is 25 years ago. That's terrifying, really, isn't it?
And then you must have an extraordinary feeling when you start to influence events. You were interviewed not long ago by the Oldie about the great Rick Mail, the New Statesman. And I think you said that MPs started to imitate
him. No, absolutely. Well, President of the United States, of course.
I think that...
Complete bastard.
Yes, he is a bastard. Yeah. American bastard.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, the ploy that we would discuss for next week's episode, with Rick usually, although Rick wasn't at all interested in politics, but you can just see Trump must sit in the Oval Office and say, now what can we do this week?
I think...
What's this week's episode?
Yeah. There was...
Well, why don't we get the president of Ukraine over and just completely fucking over?
I think...
Unbelievable.
That, I mean, there was one story for the New Statesman, which I don't even remember if we ever did, but it was going to be that that Alan was basically going to destabilise the entire world economy simply to short the shares. And... Well, we've seen how that works out. So, if you work on the basis that the most despicable thing you can think of, if it hasn't happened, will happen, then if you get in there first, then...
Well, the story we decided in the first series, I think it was, is Alan Bastard takes hold of a consignment of nuclear waste, but he hasn't got anywhere to put it. So he decides to bury it under a primary school in Hull until such time as he can get it out and then sell it on. Okay. About 4 weeks, 3 weeks later, there's a big story breaks. Nuclear waste found under a primary school in Grimsby. And then, of course, all the politicians thought there's someone in the house tipping us off.
Right.
They weren't. It was just... crazy things, and of course it's all kind of, I wish Rick was alive now to see Donald Trump, because he would just say, well, that's what I do.
I did, you must be careful for libel reasons, but any particular MPs inspire Bastard?
No. Not really. We had help from a few, but no
Michael
one...
Michael Portillo, you talked to.
Michael was very helpful, and then when the first show went out, and we said, what do you think of it? He said, well, unfortunately, my VHS didn't work, and we thought you were going to go far.
Right.
But there were a couple of MPs who are no longer with us who were very vociferous about what an outrage it was, even though they couldn't possibly have seen it at that time.
Oh, yes.
We had a lot of that.
They both subsequently had to resign because of the excess interest in the trousers of small boys. So we thought that was a moral victory for us.
But since then, and of course, when people are introduced to us at political events, or particularly Labour Party events, although not wholly, and someone says, you know, this is Maurice Grandlaurance, once they wrote news, say, oh, yes, 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 we know about the news. Conservatives are interesting. We were invited, weren't we, to the Conservative Party conference because our book had just come out, and we were sitting on the table next to Cecil Parkinson.
We were sharing the table selling our books.
Post the scandal, this must have been.
Yes,
here, yeah.
But,
yeah,
of course, he knew that we had mentioned the scandal in one of the episodes.
Oh, yes.
So there was that. And then I met Margaret Thatcher at a Geoffrey Archer lunch at the Conservative Party conference. I don't think she wanted to talk about New Statesman. She didn't mind talking about Love Hurts, which apparently she had seen, and said, you're a very clever boy, and just disappeared.
Oh, yes, because they're really good, clever MPs pretend not to mind being teased.
Yeah.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, one of the smartest things anyone ever said was we'd been particularly rude to that rather plain MP who was falsely accused of wearing a Chelsea strip in bed.
Oh, David Mellor.
David Mellor.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he was... I think he might have been on Ludovic Kennedy's panel reviewing TV shows, including ours.
Did you see?
And when someone said, you know, they were very rude to you, and he said, well, comes with the territory.
Oh, yeah, that's good and tough.
Yeah.
Tell me, Lawrence, you had a tragic spark for one of your terrific... this is a radio play about Moorgate. If you're happy to tell us the terrible circumstances of that.
Well... it was our most recent piece of work. It was a two-part play for BBC Radio 4 called Moorgate, which we are currently adapting for the stage. It's the story of London's biggest ever train disaster. Happened in February 1975, in which my father was killed. Although I didn't know, I was a journalist working for the Sunday Times. Well, I wasn't at the time, but I was later. And I was just sent down to cover what was said. There's been a big incident down at Moorgate. Can you go and get the facts? So I went down there, spent the morning there, filed my copy at lunchtime. And at about 4 o'clock that afternoon, my stepmother rang and said, I think your father's on the train. Thus began a year's investigation as to why this happened. It's interesting. It was a very... popular is the wrong word. It was a very well-respected piece in the insight page of the Sunday Times, and yet I'd never said to Maurice, and he'd never said to me, that's a fantastic story, we really ought to dramatise.
Had you thought it, Maurice, or...?
No, I think it was too personal to Lawrence, and for some reason, it had never occurred to me until Lawrence told me 48 years later, about the last two people to be rescued who were trapped together in the blackness for 8 hours, assuming they were just going to die there. And they managed to succor each other. I'm not quite sure how to say that word. Sounds rude either way. And I thought, now that I am a man of the theatre, that's a good cheap play, two characters and no lighting. And that made me look into it. And the more I looked into it, the more I thought, this is gold, and it's literally hasn't even got to be dug out. Why have we never addressed it? But the radio plays don't go into the fact that Lawrence was investigating it, because they're just the chronicle of the day. But if we successfully adapt it for the stage, then Lawrence will have a sort of authorial voice as part of the piece. But it was extraordinary. I mean, I remember, because I knew Lawrence, I've known Lawrence forever, but I was working in the West End when the accident happened. I remember, you know, all the trains were disrupted and no one knew what had happened, and it was the IRA were blowing stuff up left and right. So when there was a disaster at Moorgate, that was the first thing people thought
what of. Was remarkable. And returning to the story half a century later, as we have been, was that my father, being Jewish, was the first buried. So that was a news story. That the accident occurred on Friday morning. He was buried Sunday lunchtime. And when we got to the grounds, the burial grounds, there was a huge number of press with television cameras, radio microphones, shorthand notebooks. And someone one of the attendees at the funeral said to me, look, you're a journalist, go over and tell them not to disturb, which I did. And I said, look, I'll talk to you afterwards, but really this is a very personal time. Would you mind backing off? And they did. They were very good. 3 days later, I received a call completely out of the blue, unexpected. Hello, this is Harry Evans' secretary at the Sunday Times. I wonder whether you'd like to come in and see him. And I thought, as you would, I was 24 years old. I was a novice journalist, a junior reporter, really. That he wanted to interview me about the crash. And when I got to his office, this small Yorkshireman sat me down. She got me a coffee and he said, I want you to investigate this accident and tell us why it happened. You've got a year. A year, can you imagine? And so I became a member of the Insight team of the Sunday Times by default, by death.
Right.
So out of this tragedy suddenly became a launching pad for my career, which wouldn't have happened otherwise. I know it wouldn't have happened. I had all the facilities that Sunday Times could offer. People spoke to me as soon as you picked up the phone and said, hello, this is Lawrence Marks, Insight page of Sunday Times. As I said in an article not so long ago, people that were on holiday, in meetings, off for the next fortnight suddenly appeared on the other end of the phone. No one wanted to miss the call. And so I was able to investigate it. I had all my research papers from 50 years ago, so Morris and I sitting down to plan the play wasn't that difficult because...
It wasn't distressing both then during the Insight year and now. Was it distressing writing about this terrible tragedy?
Well, at the time, of course, it's very difficult to really know. From this distance, and we're talking about 50 years, I could say it was a kind of tragedy therapy. My mind was preoccupied with who I had to interview next, what happened here. Because, of course, the thing about the Moorgate train crash was nobody knows why it happened and do not know to this day why it happened. There's lots of theories.
You think it was the driver committing suicide? It was definitely...
No, I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't think he committed... I think he didn't stop the train. I think that's the way I'd put it. I knew and learned through the engineers of London Transport that the train was in perfect working order. I knew that if the driver applied the brakes, the train would have slowed down, whether or not it would have hit the wall. It wouldn't have hit the wall at that speed. And I knew that the driver was in perfect working order.
Physical working order, anyway.
Yeah. He didn't stop
the train. There was no known physical reason for it to happen the way it happened. Someone wrote not long ago, maybe he was just daydreaming. You know,
we don't know, but we all
make mistakes. Yeah.
Yes, to say the least.
Yeah.
writing at this time, there were moments. Hearing it was much more emotional than writing it. When I heard, particularly the young policewoman in the front carriage, who was one of the two characters, who was going to work to end the first week of her job as a policewoman in the City of London, who went on the train that morning to go to a job she was excited about, an athlete who came out at the end of it without a leg. And the other man, the stockbroker who went to work, was going shopping to Sainsbury's with his wife that evening, and he never stood vertically again in his life.
Oh, God. Tell me on a different front, the late, great Barry Cryer, who we all knew and loved,
indeed.
He said that in any comedy or writing partnership, one of the duo is a typist, the other is a walker.
We share that.
I think initially, when we first started, when we had a typewriter, Lawrence was the typist.
Because it was my typist.
It was his typewriter. Quite quickly, probably within the first year, we actually probably destroyed two or three typewriters, pounding up them. Then we got a very primitive word processor where you could see about 10 words before you committed them to type. And then when we broke that, the local, the guy at the local typewriter shop said, "You may not, you may be interested, but I had this geezer in the other day, and he's got this thing. I don't quite know what it is. It's sort of like a typewriter connected to a television set." And he said, "You might want to go and check him out." So we, this ended up in 1981.
80.
As early as that. Yeah. Having
pioneered this, the computer.
This first computer. So when we went, when we sold our first pilot and it was commissioned to a series, and then you deliver a script and the head of comedy would can you, it's very good, but I think scene two and scene three probably be the other way around, and I don't think that character works. When can I have a rewrite? And we'd say, tomorrow. And
that was very interesting.
And so they thought we were idiot savants.
Right.
He was.
Because before it would have taken a huge amount of work. Yeah.
Well, he said 2 weeks is what he actually said. He said, can you give me this in 2 weeks? And Morris or I said, you can have it in the morning. And he thought, this is amazing. And he also said that your first drafts are better than our experienced writer's 10th draft. Of course, he didn't know why.
Right.
And he then said to Michael Grade, who was at that time controller of the channel, I think I've just met two geniuses. Not only are their first drafts, they're kids, you know, and they're wonderful. So, and then they do these rewrites overnight. Nobody had even heard of it.
No one realised, because it was such early days, the significance of scripts being delivered on paper with little perforations down
Right. Oh, yeah, how funny.
So, but subsequently, we both sit and basically the typing and the walking, because we're both getting old and we both have to look after our eyesight.
No, it's not true. I mean, Sue's ever the, sitting behind the keyboard.
But, you know, it's the arguing, really, that it's all about.
So I was going to ask, you've known each other since you were both 10 or 11?
10,
right? So you now, do you know what the other one's thinking at any one time when you're discussing a script?
To a degree. I mean, not entirely. I mean, Lawrence...
The job is really about argument. People always say to us that are interviewing us, not you, of course, do you ever argue? And you'd say, what marriage doesn't argue? Because that's really...
I'd rather didn't use the M-word, because it would be a bit icky.
But it's true. I mean...
I think that...
Barry Cryer, of course, was the first person that we ever met.
One of the first.
Well...
We met Barry Cryer... because the first big break we got was writing for Frankie Howard, and we had delivered a script to Frankie Howard's house, and Frank had taken it to the back parlour of his very nice house, Edward Square, not so far from here, because Barry Cryer was there. He was writing ad libs for that night's Parkinson show. And so he showed it to Barry and said, "This isn't any good." And Barry said, he looked at it and said, "It's fantastic. You're lucky to have them." Anyway, Barry emerged, and he could see, you know, we were a bit shell-shocked, took us to the pub, and we said, "Whatever you said to Frank, thank you." And he said, "Lesson one, writers stand by each other." And in comedy... I'm not sure it's still true, it was true then. About 5 years later, Frank contacted us out of the blue and said, "Come over and have a drink." And I've got this script here by some bloke called David Nobbs. "Is it any good?" Well, David Nobbs was streets ahead of us. he'd written five...
But Frank was fine.
Frank never heard of him. So we said, "Masterpiece, Frank, you're lucky to have him."
But so when you're arguing, it's not an angry argument, it's saying that's not going to work. No. That will work.
That's stupid. Why put her there when she should be?
It's platonic at its finest.
But it does get rather heated. I will just tell you, if I may.
Yeah, that's a great story.
When Morris and I went off to work in Hollywood, we worked in something called the Wits End Building, which was a company run by Alan McEwan, who later became our partner, Dick Clement and Neil Afrene, who I know write for your paper. Anyway, so Morris and I planted in this room to prepare the storyline.
We're next door to Dick and Ian in a room with not very thick walls.
And we're going about our daily arguing like we always do and scream.
No, that won't work. No, we were not. Can I just say, I hate to contradict you. We were not aware that we were particularly doing anything out of the ordinary.
But we were, yeah.
Look. We were just behaving as we normally behave.
Anyway, so this goes on all morning, and then at lunchtime, we bang on their doors. We did every day. And sudden, no, just before
Shall I tell this story? No,
just before that, we hear this terrible argument going on next door between Dick and Ian, who have been together at least 30 years longer than we have, or 20, certainly. Well, if that's your attitude, I don't really want to do this anymore. We've gone through all this success together. We've done the Lightly Lads. We've done... But if you're going to talk to me like... And this went on. Morris and I stopped immediately and just sat there and thinking, we're in the presence of the breakup of the greatest writer. Anyway, come lunchtime, we bang on the door and we say, do you want to come for lunch? And they said, yeah, all right. So we said, is everything all right in here? He said, oh, everything's absolutely fine there, Pat. He said, he wanted you to know what you sound like next door.
Funny.
And that was it.
Funny.
They were our heroes. We were very lucky to meet our heroes.
Yep. Yes, I mean, both Dick and Ian and Gorton and Simpson. You know, we had fantastic exemplars when we were trying to start out.
So it's odd now that the young writers say, we'd really want to be you. Because we know that that's how we felt with you. Meeting Dick and Ian, I have often said, the very first time we met them both, I came down three flights of stairs in Water Street and I said to Morris, if we never do anything else again, my dream has been fulfilled. Yes. I've sat in a room with the men that wrote Porridge.
And funny enough, I've interviewed them as well, and they're not dissimilar to you, the way they finish each other's sentences, disagree in a very friendly way. I'll just finish with one question. Is there a writing strength that each of you respects in the other?
No.
No, we have no respect for each other whatsoever.
But it's Lawrence, not, it's not the case that one of you is particularly good at some aspect and one of you...
I think that may have been so at the beginning. I mean, we've worked together now for 45 years full-time.
I think Lawrence occasionally is capable of very surprising tangents. Some of which are good.
I think at the beginning it was who writes the jokes, who writes the story. But it's never been like that. I mean, when we sit down to plan, well, let's just talk about Birds of a Feather, for example. Morris had this anecdote. The anecdote became an idea. We discussed it with Linda and Pauline, two robbers' wives. They go down for 12 years, one moves in with the other. Having got that far in the planning, or the architecture, I'd call it, then, of course, the story... We're good storytellers. Yes. And I think that's the truth.
But I don't really like... I both like and dislike the phrase, it writes itself. I like the consumer to feel like it writes itself. I want the viewer or the listener... to feel that story unfolded in the only way it could have unfolded.
But you'll remember that when we were writing the first Birds, the very first episode, which we were then going to take back to Linda and Pauline, and the four of us were going to read it together, I think we were on about page 8 and Morris stopped typing and said, we've got a mega hit on our hands here. Now, he must have known that because we stopped... They seemed to be talking to us, these characters. We didn't even know they were going to be called Sharon and Tracy at that time.
And they acted it so beautifully. Oh, yeah.
They did, and we had them in mind, and of course there was a tremendous synergy between the characters and the actors, which is great, and which is another reason why if you can write for your chosen actor, it's usually a boon. Occasionally it isn't, because you find yourself... writing what that person did last time out, but it's a privilege. You know, I don't normally use the word privilege in the same sentence as the word actor, but it's a privilege to work with good actors who are not mad.
Yes. If you can find me.
Well, that's a very good place to stop, and thanks so much to Marks and Gran for appearing on Radio Aldi.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.